The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Iraq is being called a false flag operation carried out by the Americans themselves. Now, this is according to Iraqi resistance groups such as Hatab Hezbollah. Following the attack, U.S. President Donald Trump accused Iraqi resistance group and Iran of being behind the attack. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has warned the U.S. that Trump will bear full responsibility for any adventurism on his way out. Well, stay with us as we take a look at the ins and outs of this on this debate.
The United States has intensified its rhetoric against Iraqi resistance groups after its embassy in Baghdad came under a rocket attack a week ago. The attack in the city's heavily fortified grain zone only caused material damage. The U.S. military and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blamed it on Iraqi resistance groups they say are affiliated with Iran. President Donald Trump even took a step further, directly accusing Iran of being behind the attack. On his Twitter page, Trump posted an image of three rockets, claiming that they had come from Iran.
Our embassy in Baghdad got hit Sunday by several rockets. Three rockets failed to launch. Guess where they were from? Iran.
Trump's allegation drew a fierce reaction from the top Iranian diplomat.
Donald Trump uses a worthless photo to recklessly accuse Iran. Last time, the U.S. ruined our region over WMD fabrications, wasting $7 trillion and causing 58,976 American casualties. Far worse this time, Trump will bear full responsibility for any adventurism on his way out.
The Iranian foreign minister also lashed out at Trump for threatening his country with military action. Zarif said Trump is putting Americans at risk abroad to divert attention from his own catastrophic failures inside America. Meanwhile, the Iranian foreign ministry warned Washington against instigating tensions. The ministry also described as suspicious the December 20 attack at the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. That was also echoed by Kataib Hezbollah, a faction of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units that played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists in Iraq. Kataib Hezbollah said the U.S. embassy attack was a false flag strike and a plot hatched by rulers in Washington to ratchet up pressure on Iraqi resistance groups. It also said it is only American officials who benefit from an attack on their embassy. The tensions come ahead of the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes near Baghdad. The January 3rd assassination intensified anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq. After the Trump-authorized terrorist act, the Iraqi parliament voted overwhelmingly in favor of a resolution calling for the expulsion of U.S. forces from the country. Iraqis are now even more furious at the U.S. That's because President Trump has pardoned four contractors of private security firm Blackwater for killing 14 Iraqi civilians in 2007. It seems that the U.S. has to make a decision: stay in Iraq where it's unwelcome or leave the Arab state.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Jonathan Fryer, author and political commentator out of London, and Syed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator also out of London. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start it off with Jonathan. Now, the U.S. is being accused of perhaps this being a false flag attack implemented against its own embassy. How likely of a possibility is that, in your opinion?
I think one has to be pretty skeptical about that, quite frankly, although we can't know for sure who carried out this attack. It strikes me as being extremely unlikely that the Americans would do this themselves. It is interesting, though, that nobody has claimed responsibility, unlike the attacks that we've seen over the last few days on convoys of US-led convoys in Iraq, where, for example, the Qasim al-Jabarin resistance group has claimed responsibility for that. So I think, you know, we have to be keep an open mind on it, quite frankly. But what is certain is that, of course, there is a lot of resistance in Iraq to the continued presence of the American forces, and whoever was responsible, I suspect, is making that message felt clear.
Well, Syed Mohsen, your take on that. I mean, we've seen the Iraqi resistance groups, usually if they are responsible for something, they don't hesitate to take that responsibility. Your perspective on the same question, and what would the U.S. gain by attacking near its own embassy?
Well, the truth is you have to look at the motivations and who will gain, who will lose. I think it, rather than even the Americans or let alone the Hashd Shaabi or the Qatayb, mobilization forces, popular mobilization forces, we can't forget that Mossad and Israel have a huge interest in creating conflict in Iraq as well. Of course, it's the major front that they would like to open up as a war or a base for a war against the Islamic Republic of Iran. My money is on Mossad trying to corner the United States into doing what they want, which is to engage in some kind of military action against Iran primarily. But also, let's not forget that up to the Euphrates, the Israelis have something called the Yinon Plan, which they're still very much committed to. And, some would argue that they've occupied many of these Arab nations. You can see all the normalization that's going on. The Iraqis haven't, although the Americans and the Zionists do have huge influence within large sectors of the Iraqi political landscape. So my money would be really to point the finger at the main beneficiary of any conflict here. And I think that, quite frankly, would be Israel, whose primary objective would be to put Iran out of Iraq, to have no influence, no trade, no connection with the Iraqi, if you like, peoples, offer no support for an Iraq which would then be left absolutely vulnerable to Zio-American imperialism, towards Daesh, towards ISIS, and towards general balkanization and fragmentation of that region. But of course, it's speculation.
Right. Well, Jonathan, following the attack, U.S. President Donald Trump blamed Iran was very aggressive in the way he made that accusation. Your assessment of what Trump is trying to do with that move? Does he want to go to war with Iran? What do you think he's trying to do, and why he did it in that way, from your own perspective, of course?
Well, Trump has certainly been ratcheting up the rhetoric against Iran for some time now, and there is a genuine fear amongst many people on both sides of the Atlantic that he could do something reckless in the last 3 weeks or so of his presidency, though I suspect that there will be wiser voices in the Pentagon and elsewhere who will hold him back. Remember, he was at one stage going to attack Iran, and at the last minute didn't do so. This is some time ago now. And that there is therefore certainly a danger in ratcheting up this rhetoric, that he raises the stakes, he raises the tension, and then awkward accidents can happen. But certainly other countries, even close friends of the United States, such as the European Union and Great Britain, have been warning the Americans very strongly not to do anything rash, because we would like to see a complete restart of the relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran, which we hope might be possible with Joe Biden, or at least the beginnings of that new relationship. But Trump seems to want to, so to speak, stick his oar in and cause problems before that happens, and make it as difficult as possible, so that when Joe Biden actually takes over next month, the situation is dire.
Syed Mohsen, it appears that Washington is very nervous as we approach the anniversary of the martyrdom of the Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the American intelligence services have made their evaluations. They know perfectly well that the ballistic missile power that is at the disposal of the Islamic Republic of Iran They know perfectly well that the situation in Iraq, which has a huge popular feeling against their occupation, because technically that's what it is. The Iraqi parliament has told the American forces to leave. They've made some nominal efforts to reduce the forces there, but it's very superficial. That all of this points to really America having no place in that region, to be fair. And I think that the longer that they try to stick it out, the worse it's going to get, because Qataib, you've got Badr, and you've got the Hezbollah groups, which are determined that actually the will of the Iraqi people and the autonomy and the sovereignty of the Iraqi people is maintained. Of course, the Americans say, we don't want to move out because we're going to leave the ground completely empty for the Islamic Republic of Iran to dominate Iraq. Well, look, the fact of the matter, Mosia, is that Iran is a neighbor. It's part of the region. It has a $12 billion to $15 billion annual trade already with Iraq. It's going to push that to $20 billion. There's nothing that the Americans can actually do to stop Iraq and Iran having positive fraternal relationships. In fact, Iran was happy to work alongside the Americans, at least on the whatever level they could, when ISIS and Daesh mysteriously appeared in Mosul and overnight seemed to start taking over large swathes of Iraq, which was something very surprising considering the Americans' intelligence and security capabilities are next to next to none. They've got basically the best in the world, yet they couldn't detect the rise of ISIS and Daesh. How can the Iraqi establishment trust the Americans on any level? It was the Islamic Republic of Iran, in fact, with General Soleimani and the intervention of the good force in terms of supporting the building up of the popular mobilization units in a way that they could resist the Daesh and Tafiri threat, which, by the way, is, of course, alleged to be an American-sponsored reality, because we know from the WikiLeaks, Jacob Grossman launched to Hillary Clinton, confirming that Al-Qaeda, etc., were working with the Americans in Syria. That applies to the entire region, as far as I'm concerned. So I don't know why the Iraqi people need to tolerate American, hypocrisy and double games in the region anymore. And Trump, to be honest with you, it's going to be probably less. I don't think Biden's going to be any better. Biden's track record on wars is much worse than Donald Trump's. Let's get one thing absolutely right. No American president has ever been good on this front, but certainly the notion that Donald Trump will leave and there will be no longer be a threat, I think, is a red herring.
What about that, Jonathan? I mean, what would you say is the main reason that Americans are staying in Iraq? The majority of Iraqis have called for the U.S. to leave, and of course, people in the region are also making that same call. Your take on why is the United States still in Iraq?
Well, there still is this lingering belief in circles of power in Washington that it is the United States' responsibility to have a proactive role in the Middle East region. It's used, of course, to be connected with oil, but that's a much less important issue these days because the America's own production of hydrocarbons and also the decline in oil production. But this really needs a mindset change in Washington to accept that it isn't America's role to be all over the Middle East, and particularly in Iraq. They've been in Iraq now for 17 years, and we've heard already the awful toll of lives and destruction that's been caused because of their involvement here. So it really is time that they agreed to pull out. They said earlier today that they expected the forces would be reduced to about 2,500 next month, but that should keep going down. They should really have a proper schedule for withdrawal, and that would be in the interests of Americans as well as of Iraqis and, of course, Iranians.
Said Mohsen, how likely would attacks such as the one that took place near the American embassy, how likely are these type of attacks that could be used to justify the Americans actually staying inside of Iraq because of a lack of stability?
Absolutely. I mean, they used the excuse of Daesh and ISIS and the attacks, and those are continuing. in Kirkuk only this week. We've seen Daesh very, very active, although the Iraqis have actually arrested, evidently, the leader of the remainder of the Daesh forces, who are very, very small in number, but they're there. And they've arrested him, I think, in Kirkuk, he was operating in the Nineveh region. So this business of ISIS and Daesh is one major issue that continues to linger for Iraq. Of course, the problem really lies in the respect that the American establishment, or the industrial military arms complex, and the corporate, transnational corporate, you know, arms industry, in really relinquish this whole. $7.5 trillion has been spent on wars in West Asia by the Americans over the last 20, 30 years since Saddam, etc. They've actually been relentless. And Donald Trump himself said when he came into office that they'd achieved nothing. And that's the reality. In Iraq, they didn't do what they said. They came in, they did their shock and awe, destroyed the country, and then had no, it seems, no real plan for rebuilding the nation or structuring it in a positive way. The restructuring financially hasn't been invested in. In fact, it's the Chinese who've now moved in, and the vacuum that was there in terms of the needs of the Iraqi infrastructure for economy and for transport and all other systems is actually now being filled potentially by China, who've offered something like $250 billion in building up the infrastructure of the Iraqi nation. Where was America? Where is America's infrastructure build-up been? What have they done? What have they done about the trauma and the misery suffered by all those people who've had loved ones killed over and over again? You know, millions of people dead, even more refugees. This is all the legacy of a failed American policy, which was all designed to really firstly siphon off oil and to try and desperately fight off the natural rights of those people in that region, and particularly also to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran. Okay. Don't forget, Iraq was used in the eight-year war to try and destroy Iran. The American policy and the Israelis hasn't changed since then.
Well, Jonathan, what, in your perspective, what will it take in order for the American troops to leave the region, and especially Iraq?
Well, I think it requires quite a sea change in public opinion amongst the Americans themselves, Marzia, as you will probably be aware with your own origins, thinking back to the time of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. The American presence in Vietnam became unsustainable, particularly when the American public no longer accepted that this was a war that they wished to be involved in. And I think there's got to be that sea change in the American public opinion these days, that they don't want this sort of adventurism in the Middle East, and particularly in Iraq, after such a long period there at such high cost, and that really there are other priorities. It is ironic that Donald Trump actually put his finger on that and said that really they have achieved nothing, which is a very frank and true assessment. But he didn't follow it through. He's gone on and ahead, urged on by Mike Pompeo and others to carry this maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic of Iran and so on. But I think if we see that sea change in American public opinion, then that will happen, because some American politician, it may not be Biden, it may maybe after Biden, will then realize that actually, just as Britain withdrew from east of Suez many years ago, realizing it was no longer a great imperial power and shouldn't be, so should America now.
Well, Said Mohsen, I have just about 1 minute left, but, you know, with resistant groups in the region, of course, have demanded the exit of American troops, and they say that as long as American troops are in the region, there will be instability. Your take on the connection, is there a connection, first of all, in your perspective, between instability in the region and American troop presence?
Absolutely there is. I mean, had they been sincere, we would have seen a lot more stability. They could cooperate, they could ease tensions with the Iranians, they could have had far more of a policy of fraternity. The fact is, they did go for the maximum pressure. They're using Iraq as a base for their military presence, not only to control, steal some of that oil and to try and dominate the region, but they're also using it for Israel's Yinon plan purposes, and they're also using it as a base to potentially fight Iran. This is unacceptable. The Iraqi people deserve their independent sovereign status. They deserve to be left alone after the millions that have been traumatized, killed, murdered, and maimed. It's enough is enough. And of course, we know that the world politics no longer has any issue about human rights. We can't plead to them. The only thing that will work ultimately is the threat of military and physical, if you like, aggression, which is powerful enough to make sure that the Americans know that it's game, set, and match. It's time for them to leave. Otherwise, it'll be body bag time, and they will suffer. They won't be fighting Saddam this time. They're fighting the popular mobilization forces. They're fighting resistance axes and a regional force that is fed up with the Americans in that area.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the debate. Jonathan Breyer, author and political commentator out of London, and Syed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, also out of London. Pleasure having both of you. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Hope to see you right here, same time, next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And they urge you to hasten the punishment, but Allah will never fail in His promise. And indeed, a day with your Lord is like 1,000 years of those which you count.
So, dear listeners, we're done talking about the 46th verse of the chapter. The 47th one, however, starts saying, ويستعجلونك بالعذاب, and they demand of you to hasten on the punishment. ولن يخلف الله وعده. While does never Allah fail His promise, وَإِنَّ يَوْمًا عِنْدَ رَبِّكَ كَأَلْفِ سَنَةٍ مِمَّا تَعُدُّونَ. And verily, a day with your Lord is as a thousand years of what you number. In this verse, the Holy Quran makes manifest another feature of the ignorance and unawareness of the blind-hearted pagans. The divine prophets used to warn the disbelievers of the divine punishment, but they frequently asked the prophets what time would the punishment of Allah come. This verse answered them not to hasten, since the promise of Allah is certain. So we should not consider the respite of Allah as a sign for His negligence, or we assume that we are delivered, because the verse says, وَيَسْتَعْجِلُونَكَ بِالْعَذَابِ, and they demand of you to hasten the punishment. Ignorance of the Almighty Allah is not conceivable. It's not possible to think that the Almighty Allah is ignorant of the punishment. The person who fears that he might lose the opportunity he has and his potentialities end usually hastens. But for Allah, who has been all-powerful over everything and will be powerful, He's always able to fulfill His promises, and haste is meaningless for Him. There is no difference for Him whether time is 1 hour, 1 day, or 1 year, or 1,000 years. Its reason is mentioned in the verse, and it says, إِنَّ يَوْمًا عِنْدَ رَبِّكَ كَأَلْفِ سَنَةٍ مِمَّا تَعُدُّونَ. Verily, a day with your Lord is as 1,000 years of what you number. So, whether sincerely or mockingly, the disbelievers reiterate this statement, saying why the divine punishment does not come down over them. They should know that the divine chastisement waits for them, and sooner or later it will come to them. So, if there is a respite given to them, which has always been one of the sunan and laws of the Almighty Allah, it is for that they may awake and improve themselves. Yet, they must be careful that after the punishment has been sent down, the doors to repentance and return are totally closed, and there is no way to escape the punishment.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Also, concerning this part of the verse, where it says, وَإِنَّ يَوْمًا عِنْدَ رَبِّكَ كَأَلْفِ سَنَةٍ مِمَّا تَعُدُّونَ, there have been mentioned some other commentaries too. Among them is that you may need 1,000 years for doing something, but Allah's performance is in one day or less than that. So his punishment does not need so many premises. Another matter is that, in comparison, one day in the hereafter is like 1,000 years in the world, and its reward and attribution will also be increased with the same scale. In this regard, an Islamic narration indicates, verily the poor will enter paradise before the rich in half a day, which is 500 years. So now we know that about the part where it says إِنَّ يَوْمًا عِنْدَ رَبِّكَ كَأَلْفِ سَنَةٍ مِمَّا تَعُدُونَ, we have just mentioned a couple of the possible interpretations, and there have been recorded in other books different possible meanings for this part of the verse. Anyway, the whole point of the verse was to know that it's not always the Almighty Allah's favor that he's giving respite and time. Sometimes the time and respite is given for us to be awakened, to be aware that we're going on the wrong way. But sometimes it is only for us to continue doing our indecent works. And it's the only respite that is given for our chastisement. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hazrat Fatima's martyrdom points to ponder. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam everybody and condolences on the anniversary of a very poignant occasion. Today happens to be the 13th of the Islamic month of Jamadil Awwal. It is the day on which, according to an account, the virtuous ever lady departed from the mortal world. It is a day of grief, marked in Iran and wherever Muslims, especially the followers of the Prophet's blessed Ahlul Bayt or household, live. Despite the spread of the coronavirus pandemic, the devotees are clad in black these days in the memory of the lady who, in order to safeguard the spirit and letter of God's revealed word, the noble Quran, for ensuring eternity of humanitarian values, not just sacrificed her peace and life, but also gave to the world illustrious offspring who caught a martyrdom in their own eras so that truth stands forever triumphant over falsehood. Who was she? What calamities befell her? Why was she martyred? Where is her grave? Thought-provoking questions indeed. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. O Allah, send blessings upon the chaste, immaculate, the veracious, the infallible, the pious, pure, the amiable, the well-pleased, the virtuous, the upright, the oppressed, the wronged lady whose right was usurped, whose inheritance was usurped, whose rib was broken, whose husband was persecuted, and whose son was slain. As said earlier, today we are in the state of mourning for the lady mentioned in the passage that we recited now from her ziyara, or standard form of salutation, which is indeed a testimony to her unsurpassed merits, as well as the magnitude of her sorrows. The 13th of the month of Jamadil Awwal is the day on which, according to several narrations, the noblest lady of all times left the mortal world in the prime of her youth, while defending the dignity of women in Islam, the right to own and inherit, the right to protest against social injustice, and the right to support walaya, or divinely designated leadership of mankind. As a matter of fact, she attained martyrdom in defense of her husband, whose divinely decreed right of political leadership of the Islamic Ummah had been usurped by a clique of incompetent persons who had hijacked the caliphate and were misleading the Muslim masses. She was none other than Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, peace upon her, the immaculate daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Born in Mecca to the impeccable lady Hazrat Khadija, peace upon her, less than a year after her father's Mi'raj, or ascension to the highest point in the heaven and back to planet Earth within a matter of few moments, and his eating of the blessed apple of paradise during the celestial journey, she was named Fatima, which means her devout followers are immune from the fire of hell. While still a child of less than 8 years, she lost her mother to the cold hands of death. She had no maternal material inheritance, since her mother's vast wealth was spent for the feeding, clothing, sheltering, and protection of the neo-Muslim community that was under persecution of the pagan Arabs. Nonetheless, despite her tender years, she so diligently took care of her persecuted father to the extent that she became known as Umma Biha, or mother of her own father. Upon migration to Medina, her hand was sought by wealthy and politically influential neo-Muslim Arabs, but her father turned down all proposals, saying the commandment should come from God for the marriage of his virtuous daughter. Indeed, when her father's young and virtuous cousin, the first and foremost Muslim, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, became the suitor and received the affirmative reply, as Gabriel informed the Prophet that the nuptials of these two blessed souls were sealed in heaven by God himself. The fruits of this auspicious union were two infallible sons and two impeccable daughters, who would rise to the defense of Islam whenever the creed of God came under threat from the hypocrites, former Arab pagans who now masqueraded as Muslims to seize the political power of the Islamic realm. No wonder the Prophet used to rise to his feet whenever his daughter entered his presence and seat her in his place, saying he smelled the fragrance of heaven. To confirm her pristine purity and that of her family, God revealed Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab, when the Prophet once entered her house and assembled under his blessed cloak her young sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, her husband Imam Ali, and herself, peace upon them all. Gabriel descended with the divine words, "Indeed, Allah desires to keep away all uncleanness from you, Ahlul Bayt, and preserve you thoroughly purified." As the supreme symbol of feminine virtues, she displayed the highest ethical traits. In 70 AH, when the Prophet provided her with the virtuous Abyssinian maid Fezze, she divided the work equally by giving rest to her maid a whole day after a day's work and discharging the duties that day herself. These are the qualities that make Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, the pride of the Virgin Mary, and the model par excellence for all virtuous women to mold their life upon. It would not be out of context to say that following divine commandment, the Prophet made a gift of his personal property of Fadak to his dear daughter on revelation of Ayah 26 of Surah Isra, which reads, "Give the nearest of kin their due right, and the needy and the traveler as well." On revelation of this ayah, the Prophet called his daughter Fatima and said, "Fadak is one of the territories for which we did not exhaust our horses or camels to acquire it. It is mine exclusively. Now I gift it to you and your offspring according to God's instructions." Alas, no sooner did the Prophet depart from the mortal world, her property was seized by the coup leaders of Medina, following their usurpation of the political right of leadership of her husband, Imam Ali, peace be upon him. The Muhaddithah as she is known because of the fact that angels used to speak with her, was martyred barely 75 days after the prophet's passing away, when an unruly group of her father's companions, intending to force her husband to swear allegiance to their political rule, flung the burning door of her house upon her, without any respect for her status, thereby pinning her to the wall and resulting in miscarriage. The stillborn son, Mohsen. Thus, this Siddiqa, or the most truthful lady who was free from all impurities, died in defense of the right of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, after delivering a memorable sermon in flawless Arabic on the fundamentals of Islam and on the governance of the Islamic society on the basis of the Noble Quran and the precedents of the Prophet. She warned the caliph and his companions of divine punishment for their unjustified actions, including their seizure of Fadak, whose income she used to spend on the poor and the needy. She told them, "Now hang firmly to this cheap dromedary of caliphate of yours. But be aware, the hump of this camel is injured while there are blisters and holes in his feet. It carries the scars of ignominy and the sign of the wrath of Allah. Eternal shame is attached to it." In Sahih Bukhari, the book of hadith venerated by our Sunni brethren, the Prophet is quoted as saying, "Fatima is a part of me. Whoever displeases her has displeased me. And whoever displeases me has indeed displeased God." So why a paragon of virtue whom God hails in the Noble Quran as Kothar, or the blessed spring of perpetual abundance, was displeased? Weren't the companions of the Prophet aware of her prime position as the fulcrum of faith? Hadn't they watched in amazement and admiration the veiled figure of the Immaculate Lady accompany her father, along with her husband and two sons, to the memorable Mubahale with the Christians of Najran on revelation of Ayah 61 of Surah Al Imran? Weren't they aware that Ayahs 5 to 22 of Surah Dahr were revealed, giving tidings of the loftiest mansions in paradise to her, to her husband, to her maid Fizze, and to her sons, when they fasted for 3 consecutive days to fulfill a vow, and on each evening at the time of breaking the fast, gave away whatever food they had to a beggar, to a traveler, and a freshly released prisoner who happened to knock on the door? Muslims ought to ponder upon these questions for perfecting their faith. On her departure from the mortal world, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, carried out the wishes of his beloved wife in the dead of night, laying her to rest in an unmarked and still unknown grave in Medina, so that the shadow of those that had displeased her would never fall upon it, nor would any future blasphemers, such as the Wahhabis of our times, would be able to desecrate it. Thus, Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, the pride of the Virgin Mary, and the immortal symbol of womanhood for all virtuous women for all time, left for her heavenly abode. But the values that she bequeathed to humanity eternally remain with us, inspiring the daughters of Eve towards faith in God and moral perfection. We again offer condolences to our listeners and goodbye.
Around the World with Reporters.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a wide air raid targeting various positions in the besieged Gaza Strip in the early hours of Saturday. The Israeli airstrikes caused damages to hospitals, mosques, and agricultural lands in the east of the Strip, and two civilians were reported injured. Israel claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza.
Targeting civilians in industrial areas indicates that the Israeli army has been encouraged by the recent normalization deals with a number of Arab states to further violate Palestinian rights. But we will continue our resistance against Israeli aggression.
Resisting groups here stressed the Israeli army's crimes over Gaza and targeting civilians amount to violations of international law.
The Israeli army continues to commit crimes against our people. The airstrikes have frightened civilians and led to serious damages. We are facing a violent regime. The resistance, however, we respond in case the Israeli army continues its aggression. Resistance is our only weapon. We have to defend Palestinian rights. Netanyahu is trying to escape from his political impasse by stepping up pressure against us.
Palestinian groups say Israeli army should be held accountable for its crimes. Israeli occupation exacerbated the already dire condition Palestinians are living through, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The airstrikes violate all international laws because Israeli army targets hospitals and residential areas. We hold the Israeli occupation responsible for all the consequences of this aggression.
The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing rocket fire from the enclave. Palestinians here say that Israeli army violates all international laws by damaging hospitals and targeting civilians. They insist their resistance is the only way to cope with the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen in 2015, Iran has stood by the Yemeni people. General Qasem Soleimani was a key figure in the Yemeni-Iranian relationship with his anti-war stance and support for Yemen's sovereignty.
There was a strong connection between the martyr Qasem Soleimani and the issue of Yemen. He gave moral support to Yemen, which is part of the axis of resistance. Martyr Qasem Soleimani was one of the most important leaders of the resistance, who had a big role in backing countries that confront the global hegemony.
We can see a growing increase of correlation between Yemenis and General Soleimani. For example, the first group of graduates from the Persian language department in Sana'a carried the name of the General Soleimani in their ceremony weeks ago.
General Soleimani is portrayed in Yemen as an important element in the resistance against the Saudi aggression. Yemenis consider him as an example of confronting arrogant powers. He has also become the symbol of a revolution that inspires people to find freedom and dignity.
Yemenis consider him as an example of confronting arrogant powers. He has also become the symbol of a revolution that inspires people to find freedom and dignity. The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani is of course a great loss for Islamic nations. However, contrary to what the US has predicted, the assassination of this iconic figure has given a great impetus to an entire generation that is pledging to continue his legacy while facing the enemies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Resistance figures from Palestine, Syria, and Iraq have marked the first martyrdom anniversary of commander of Iran's Al-Quds force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in Damascus, recalling his role in restoring stability to Syria. In a gathering, resistance delegates underlined the importance of his efforts in leading resistance in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine.
General Soleimani exerted huge efforts to support Palestinians in Gaza and occupied territories. He had a great role in raising the morale of Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli aggression. He never interfered in the internal affairs of the Palestinians.
We have gathered here to pay tribute to two great leaders of resistance who lost their lives in fight against enemies of our causes. We tell those who want to create divisions among us that we will remain united and strong and will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani.
On the 3rd of January 2020, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered strikes that killed General Soleimani and his companions near Baghdad International Airport.
Martyr Soleimani led battles in Aleppo and eastern Syria as well as around Damascus. His presence had always boosted the morale of fighters. His presence scared the enemy on the battlefield and at the same time gave power to resistance fighters.
The role of Martyr Soleimani and the alliance of Iraqi, Iranian, and Syrian resistance gave a lesson to the U.S. and its allies that they can't defeat our resistance, especially in Syria and Iraq.
Throughout the war on Syria, the general was a top strategist and military commander, leading Iranian military advisors who helped Syria at its government's request in the fight against terrorists. He frequently visited the front lines in Aleppo and Deir ez-Zor and joined resistance fighters for advisement, despite knowing he was a target for the U.S. and its allies. The general also took personal command of the battle against Daesh terrorists in the city of Bukamal and Deir ez-Zor countryside in November 2017. For resistance fighters, he was a commander and a father. For Syrians, he was a true friend and a hero. For the Syrian army, he was a brother and an ally who was there whenever needed. And this is how Martyr Qasem Soleimani will be remembered in Syria. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Afghan First Vice President Amrullah Saleh says there would be no peace and stability in Afghanistan unless regional and international players establish close cooperation in this regard. Addressing the second meeting of Afghanistan's National Reconciliation Council, Saleh also said the war in Afghanistan is fueled by certain sides which benefit from war.
Every single weapon or technology used in Afghanistan war comes from outside. So considering the intra-Afghan talks as the only way to bring peace to Afghanistan is naive. We need to take into account the external dimension of Afghan conflict as well, which is highly important.